on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. We're just about 7 weeks away from the election as one of America's most divisive and unpredictable presidential campaigns continues to challenge political norms. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton blast each other as unfit for office as charges of deplorable and racist and hateful fly from both camps. The tumultuous presidential campaign has led to uncertainty up and down the ballots of both major parties. Washington Post syndicated columnist E.J. Dionne joins me as we try to make sense of the rapidly evolving electoral landscape. Then the iconoclastic punk rock band Deerhoof. Producer Max Savage Levinson sits down with the band's co-founder, Maryland native Greg Saunier, who'll explain how a band that's never had a hit is still going strong after more than two decades on the road. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus first. The news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody, and welcome to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Constitution Day is the 17th of September, the date in 1787, when 39 men signed the document that has shaped the great American experiment ever since. The Maryland Institute College of Art is getting a jump on the celebration tomorrow night when, as they've done for the past dozen years, they'll sponsor a panel discussion on a pressing issue. The issue they've chosen this year is immigration, the platform from which Donald Trump launched his unlikely campaign. The panel is entitled Immigration, Racism, and the Changing Face of the Nation. I'll be moderating the panel tomorrow night, which will include my guest this morning, the award-winning Washington Post syndicated columnist E.J. Dionne. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University, and the author of several books, the latest of which is called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J. Dionne joins me on the phone from his home in Bethesda. Good morning, E.J. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Great to be back with you. And if I could, just one book plug. The book is out in paperback with the new subtitle, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond.
Yeah.
I tried to get Trump in the original subtitle. My editor said, no, let's wait. And now we have it in the paperback, and there's a new afterword about Trump. Although there was a lot of Trump in the book before.
Yes, indeed. Well, when we talked the last time, it was the day before Super Tuesday. And, of course, since that time, Trump has overwhelmed his Republican rivals. Your thesis in the book, you critique this very steady progression from Goldwater through now Trump, the Tea Party and Trump. And it's fueled in part by a disillusionment with the Republican Party because of promises they've made that they haven't been able to keep. Do you find now, at this point, 7 weeks or so before the election, that that progression is continuing? Are you seeing any blip in the chart heading towards Trump here?
I think the progression continues as long as Trump is leading the Republican Party. I think the interesting question would be what happens after the election. Obviously, if Trump wins, then all bets are off. I don't know what happens inside the Republican Party. We don't really have a clear idea of how Donald Trump will govern, given his tendency to say different things, not only on different days, but sometimes in the middle of the same speech, depending on what the audience reaction is. But I think that would create one kind of crisis in Republicanism. But if Trump loses, then I think there will be a real debate inside the Republican Party, because this will be the third loss in a row for the Republican Party. And, it's worth remembering that only one time since 1992 have the Republicans actually won the popular vote in a presidential election. So this would call for, I think some real reassessment in the party. Although my worry is that a lot of the non-Trump forces in the party, some of whom have come out against him or have said they can't vote for him, others have gone along with him, I think they might just try to curry favor with the Trump people by putting up a wall of opposition to a President Clinton, and we could be in for another difficult couple of years in that case.
It's interesting to me that the case that you make very compellingly, that the Republican Party, the so-called centrist part of the Republican Party, or the mainstream, the establishment, whatever you want to call it, has pushed people to the far right, to what's now in this cycle at least being called the alt-right, because they're making claims and making promises that they're not able to keep. The most recent perhaps being, we're going to get rid of Obamacare. And so, you know, 100 votes later to do that very thing, they've not succeeded in that. It seems to me that Trump is making all sorts of what could easily be characterized as outrageous promises as well. We're going to build a wall. You know, last week he was going to replace the generals. He's got his secret plan, supposedly, to eliminate ISIS. It's still resonating because, you know, just this morning there's a new poll that shows he's up 5 points in Ohio and that he and Clinton are tied nationally. Those promises, which seem to me to be cut from the same cloth as the promises that you talk about in your book, they're still being made and they still seem to work.
Well, we've still got a long time to go in this election. Let me just, since it's something a listener might ask at some point, my basic view of this election is that unless we repealed women's suffrage and the Voting Rights Act, the odds are still very high that Hillary Clinton wins. I think there is one way in which she could lose, and some of these polls reflect that, by the way, and that is that if the attack on her becomes very effective, if she makes some more mistakes, I think votes could go away from Clinton, not necessarily toward Trump, because I think there's a real ceiling on Trump's vote, and this is the view of a number of Republican pollsters, not just Democratic pollsters, that if the Clinton vote could be pushed either into abstention, people not turning out at all, or toward the third-party candidates, that is the one circumstance in which I see Trump winning. But the cycle of you know, over-promising, disappointment, and betrayal, I think, may be especially striking on the issue we're going to be talking about tomorrow, which is immigration, where, you know, it is understandable, by the way, that there is a lot of agitation around this issue, because if you go back to 1970, only about, I think it was 4.6% of us were foreign-born of the American population. That's up to 13%. So there clearly has been a surge of immigration since the passage of the 65 Immigration Reform Act. So it's not shocking that there is this surge. But the fact is, every American, including critics of immigration, know that you're not going to be able to deport 11 million people. Trump himself has been all over the place in his comments. He implied early on he'll deport them all. Then he went through the period where he was talking about softening. It was softening and then hardening. It sounded like we were talking about ice cream or something. And, you know, I think that we're not going to abruptly change the nature of the American population. And so I think Trump, as your question suggests, is setting up his constituency for a lot of disappointment should he be elected president. You know, on this election, a lot of people ask, you know, why is Trump so close? He's such an odd and, in the view of many, I should say, including me, a dangerous candidate. And I think the answer is history shows it's very hard for a party to hold power for three terms in a row. You know, the last time that happened was when, for Democrats, is when FDR got reelected himself a third time, and then you have to go all the way back to Martin Van Buren in 1836. So it's not an automatic thing that the party in power can hold on to the presidency for 3 years.
E.J. Dionne.
Three terms, I'm sorry.
Three terms, right. E.J. Dionne is a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Let's talk about Secretary Clinton's deplorables comment. I mean, putting aside the political calculation, which is mystifying to a lot of people as to why she would say something like that, Dana Milbank wrote in your paper a day or two ago that she wasn't wrong, that there is a high quotient of people who hold racist and xenophobic views. I understand, well, your paper is reporting this morning that the White House is raising the refugee goal to more than 110,000 people in 2017, which is a dramatic increase from last year. Do you think that's going to hurt politically, given the fact that there are an awful lot of people who hold views that are, not inconsistent with the David Dukes of the world?
Well, two things on that. First, on the basket of deplorables, it sounds like an indie rock group. Somebody should pick that up.
It would be a very good name. You're right.
Yeah. But, there are two things about this. One is presidential candidates are candidates, not political analysts, and they always get into trouble when they offer some kind of statement like this. President Obama did when he talks about people who cling to their guns and religion, even though actually the statement as a whole, when you looked at it, I talk about this in the book actually, was very sympathetic to people who have been hammered by the economy. Nonetheless, he got into trouble for that unfortunate quote. Romney obviously got into trouble for his 47% quote. And so you just don't do that. Clinton shouldn't have done that. But on the truth of the matter, it's interesting. The New York Times over the weekend, during this big debate, posted a story that they had published in February studying the Trump campaign closely. And I'm quoting the New York Times story here. Trump, they said, quotes, built a significant part of his coalition of voters on people who are, very diplomatic here, people who are responsive to religious, social, and racial intolerance. So it is clearly true that a significant segment, it may well be half, as my colleague Dana Milbank made that case, are in fact responsive to these appeals to intolerance. And I think the reason this Clinton statement will prove to be somewhat different than the Romney 47%, and I was talking actually yesterday to a Romney person about this who didn't really disagree, that, there was no way he could defend the idea of 47% of Americans being dependent and not want to end their dependency. In Clinton's case, they have an opportunity to shift this to the question of, well, what kind of campaign is Trump running? Is he not appealing to racism? Does he not pick up the support of the alt-right? His, the top figure in his campaign is from the Breitbart website, which is a famous kind of increasingly famous alt-right place. And when you have Mike Pence asked whether David Duke is deplorable and he refuses to say, it shows that that can be flipped around. Still in all, I'm sure Clinton wishes she hadn't said that, and she corrected herself. I had the same reaction when I saw the refugees story. I'm sure Trump is going to try to turn on that. I think it will appeal to his base again. I'm not sure most Americans actually want to say no to refugees and their families who are suffering in those circumstances.
Sure, and we'll pick up on that after a break. E.J. Dion is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, a professor at Georgetown University. His new book is called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Trump. We'll have more with E.J. Dion after this break. For the news, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Thank you, Nathan. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Tomorrow night at the Maryland Institute College of Art, MICA and the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland will celebrate Constitution Day. This is an annual event that features a panel of experts and artists discussing various aspects of that revered document. The panel this year includes the Cuban performance artist Tania Bruguera, as well as Maria Elena Hincapié, who is the executive director of the National Immigration Law Center. The topic this time around is immigration. The event is entitled Immigration, Racism, and the Changing Face of the Nation. If you've just joined us, my guest this morning will also be on that panel at MICA, Washington Post columnist and Brookings Institution's senior fellow E.J. Dion. His latest book is called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond, now available in paperback. So, EJ, let's talk about immigration. This president, President Obama, has deported more people than any other president. Is there consensus on the left, do you think, about what a comprehensive immigration reform package should look like? Do people know what we should do with immigration, or are we still at the stage where we're just not close to any consensus about that issue?
I think we're pretty close to a broad consensus, not only on the left, but in the center, if you will, and even among some parts of the right. We forget often, and you know, it's a while back that the Senate passed a bipartisan immigration bill with a lot of Republican support. I think it was 68 votes it got in the Senate that included some basic provisions, which is tougher border security, which we've already started to have under Obama. I mean, we forget that net immigration from Mexico was below zero. That is to say, there were more people going back than coming in. Now, some of that was the result of the Great Recession, where the jobs weren't here to come to, but some of it was also enforcement. But tougher enforcement, giving people a path to citizenship if they pay fines, pay back taxes, then new rules to govern immigration going forward. I think there, you know, the polling suggests there's a consensus in the country for an immigration reform that says, look, these folks are here unless they are breaking the law. If these are people who have been working hard, and in many cases paying taxes because the taxes are taken out of their paychecks and they can't then collect Social Security, when they're operating on fake Social Security numbers, if these folks are here and pay the penalty, we are all better off if all these people are not living in the shadows. I think in a broad sense, that is a consensus view. I'm not convinced, alas, that we will finally get this done, given that you may have a divided Congress and that Republicans have seen the power of the immigration issue, the anti-immigration position, pushing the Trump campaign. But it's not for lack of plausible policy proposals that this isn't happening.
Is it your assessment that Trump supporters or Trump himself is counting on people who hold very strong views against paths to citizenship, against more open immigration policies? Is he counting on what many have described as racists and xenophobes in a way that other Republicans have not, given that regardless of how this election turns out, the immigration debate can't help but be discussed moving forward after November in light of Trump's campaign?
Well, it's clear that Trump relied particularly in the primaries on opponents of immigration reform as central to his political base. And he used the immigration issue against Marco Rubio, against Jeb Bush, against John Kasich. It's very clear that this group is a hardcore part of the Trump constituency. I do want to say, I think it's a terrible mistake for those of us who are sympathetic to immigration reform to write off all opponents of all the people who disagree with us as simply racists and xenophobes. Of course, there are racists and xenophobes in the country. You see it on signs at rallies. You hear it in things shouted. But there are other people who are just kind of worried about, for example, sudden changes in their neighborhoods or in their communities from the surge of immigration. People are made to feel uncomfortable. That's happened before in our history. You know, when Italians and Irish and Poles came in. So there is that. There are some people who fear that immigrants, particularly illegal immigrants, have a downward impact on wages. There's evidence of a modest downward impact, although I would sort of argue with them to say, look, if you're worried about that, we'd all be better off if these immigrants were legal and could actually be protected by the same labor laws that protect the native-born. But I'm uneasy with writing off everybody who disagrees with, say, the position I take as racists and xenophobes. I think that opposition to immigration reform goes beyond that group, and there is that part of the group who oppose immigration reform, I think, are folks we who support it can have a real dialogue with.
You know, the immigration law or the immigration debate seems to come down to this matter of trustworthiness with both candidates. I'm interested that the LA Times yesterday had a piece on Helen Aguirre Ferre, who's the director of Hispanic communications for the RNC. So she's now in a position of having to defend Mr. Trump, a guy that she once compared to a street dog. And she's you know, quoted in the LA Times as saying, "I'm not actually sure what his immigration policy is going to be." So, and there's some question as to whether she has any influence at all on Trump when it comes to the Latino vote or his position on immigration. So there's a trust issue on the right, and obviously there's, you know, a continuing trust issue on the left. What do you make of this notion that you know, there's such high distrust of both people? You write in your book that a decline in trust of political parties has been accompanied by a rise in partisanship. Is this also part of this progression of polarity between the parties? And, you know, are we further and further away from finding some comity in the general electorate?
Well, there's a great political scientist called Alan Abramowitz who's written some very good stuff over recent years about the rise in negative partisanship, that increasingly we, meaning all of us, define our views on left or right primarily in opposition, not only to the politicians of the other side, but often to each other. There's just this deep gap between people who are center-left or left and center-right or right. And this creates a degree of mistrust. I think also after the Great Recession combined with rising inequality, stagnating wages, there was a general mistrust of institutions and whether they were delivering for average people. We did finally, by the way, have some good news on income growth yesterday from the Census Bureau, which showed actually the wages, incomes at the bottom for 2015 rose faster than for any other group. That's, I think, important for the long haul. But in this campaign, I think it's important to be clear. You know, Clinton's position on this issue has been very clear from pretty much the time she was in the Senate to now. She hasn't shilly-shallied on the immigration issue. Trump, as I said earlier, went through that very embarrassing period where he sort of sent out his own trial balloon saying, you know, from day to day, I'm softening. No, really, I'm hardening. I think we know where you know, Trump has stood in terms of how he's willing to demagogue the issue. His comments on a Mexican judge is who he said, and the judge was not Mexican, he was Mexican-American, who couldn't be fair to him. His original, you know, the very kickoff of the campaign when he talked about immigrants from Mexico as rapists. I mean, I think we should be sort of open-minded about all the people who might be opposed to immigration reform, but Trump has sent these really hard and in some cases outright racist signals, and yet on policy he has flip-flopped. And so I think his core base is going to believe that he is going to be with them one way or the other, but everybody else has reason to wonder what does he stand for on this or anything else.
E.J. Dion is my guest. He's a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post. His latest book is a beaut. It's called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You wrote a column a couple days ago in the Post talking about one of the many ways in which this election has sort of flipped. You know, you're talking about religion in particular, but you also mentioned that this is the year that the Republican candidate is the one saying that the United States isn't great anymore, and the Democrats are insisting that it is. In your book, you write about the party's embrace of Ronald Reagan, and you say that he stole optimism. This is Reagan, stole optimism from FDR, and Bill Clinton stole it back. Trump's campaign has been premised on anything but optimism. It's a very pessimistic view of the country and the current state of affairs. Again, given that, are you surprised that he's as solidly he's doing as well as he's doing in the polls?
Well, I guess, a little surprised the race is this close, but not that surprised. I mean, when you look at how partisan we have become, almost anybody running on one party ticket or the other is guaranteed about 40% of the vote going in. Heck, I could probably declare as a Republican and get 40%, and I'm not saying that that means I'm great, or a Democrat the other way around. That's not surprising. And as I say, I think after 8 years of any incumbent, it's hard for a party to take power. It is, by the way, why I think the model campaign in many ways for Hillary Clinton is George H.W. Bush's campaign in 1988 after Ronald Reagan was president for two terms, where Bush sent signals that he would represent continuity with Ronald Reagan and correct in a couple of areas, education and the environment, where voters wanted a correction. But I do think that in the end, Americans do not go for a deeply pessimistic campaign. And I think the pessimism that's inherent in Trump reflects the fact that a lot of his supporters are older white Americans who in some cases were hammered by the economy and I think have absolutely the legitimate grievances to be mad. I'm not sure. I don't think Donald Trump is actually the best expression of that, as President Obama said yesterday, but I sure get why they're angry. Some of the same people in that group are uneasy about the cultural changes in the country, whether we're talking about the changes wrought by immigration or changes like the rise of gay marriage. And so this is a very conservative, older constituency that doesn't like the direction the country has gone in. I don't think they represent a majority of the country, but it's a very large group of Americans.
But isn't it also the case that there are an awful lot of folks who just have in their gut a bad feeling about Secretary Clinton? I mean, she had a very bad weekend, starting with Friday and her comments about the deplorables and finishing up on Sunday when she has to leave the World Trade Center commemoration of 9/11 and had a fainting spell related to an illness. She's had a rotten time, and she's, you know, folks have said that she's lost her post-convention bump. What does she need to do to reinvigorate her campaign at this juncture?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton should kind of try to flip the script here and become the candidate of transparency. She has already released over 30 years of her tax returns. I think she should keep challenging Trump on that. And she can do it when she releases, as she said she will, more medical information. I think that a presidential candidate getting pneumonia should not be a major problem for that presidential candidate. I think that the Clinton campaign ran into trouble because they were slow in just saying outright, hey, she's got pneumonia. And sometimes when you fail to say something, and you know, Clinton supporters would say, I think legitimately, that she is being judged by a different standard. She probably is. But she is a candidate who knows she is being judged by that standard, and she has to live with it. Therefore, I think it was incumbent on her campaign to say quickly, she has this illness, she's going to get better, and she's going to be all right. And by the way, I'm not sure yesterday hurt her at all, her staying home.
And Obama on the stump.
On the campaign trail on her behalf.
Indeed.
I think it was actually a pretty good day for her.
It was indeed. All right. Well, EJD, we look forward to seeing you tomorrow night at MICA, and I appreciate your time this morning. Thanks so much.
Always great to be with you. Thank you.
EJ Dion is a syndicated columnist with The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University. His latest book is a must-read. It's called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond. EJ Dion will be part of the panel celebrating Constitution Day tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Falvey Hall, the Brown Center on the campus of the Maryland Institute College of Art. I'll be moderating that panel. We hope you can join us. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, we'll introduce you to the founder of the band Deerhoof.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Welcome Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Since their launch in San Francisco more than two decades ago, the band Deerhoof has defied definitions and expectations. Among their more than a dozen studio albums, not a single gold. But their shifting styles have continued to endear this pioneering punk rock band to a large and loyal fan base. Producer Max Savage Levinson sat down with Deerhoof's founder and drummer, Maryland native Greg Saunier, to discuss the band's creative process and their determined celebration of chaos.
At the heart of every Deerhoof song lies a tension between the playful vocals of Satomi Matsuzaki and her bandmates' manic blasts of guitars, drums, and noise. Yet even though the band has such a distinct sound, drummer Greg Saunier,
this is Greg, the drummer from Deerhoof,
explains that writing songs together has never come easy for Deerhoof.
It's like this band should never have been formed in the first place. I mean, the four of us are like, come from such different backgrounds and have different ideas of what music is supposed to be. It's just a constant clash. Each of the four of us write songs and we're bringing it into the rest of the gang. Somebody whip it out, you know, they start playing some song or they send an MP3 of some demo they recorded at home. The other three are just scratching their heads, totally and utterly baffled. We do often throw out other musical examples to each other, but the finished song almost never ends up sounding anything like what any of us had proposed.
Is that ever frustrating for you?
No, it's actually much nicer. I mean, that's the beauty of collaboration, working with other people. You have an idea in your mind, no matter how much you love it. As soon as the other three people get a hold of it, they take control of it, and it takes on a life of its own that you could never have foreseen. When you become very big, and particularly if you have one famous song, one famous album, you become associated with one sound. Your fans and your record label and whatever kind of expects you to repeat it because, well, we had a success with it last year. Can you do it? Can you pull it off again? We've never had a hit, you know? We've never become a big band. Instead of having the expectation that we'll repeat ourselves, we have this expectation coming from our actual fans themselves that will surprise them, you know, that will do something that they can't predict.
Deerhoof's recording methods can be as eccentric as their music. For their new album, The Magic, the quartet, which also includes guitarist Ed Rodriguez and John Dietrich, hold up in an empty office building in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
It was so funny. It was a fluorescent lit, totally bare, you know, just a phone not attached, sitting on this desk, otherwise completely empty in this totally forlorn office park. Every day was like, you know, something new. Somebody comes in with some song or, you know, we try something that we've been hearing a very extremely rough, you know, demo version of for a few months. And finally we get to try it full blast. And, you know, it was a thrill. It was really fun. It was very brief. It was like a week or something. And then we went straight on to a tour from there. The reason that we could even have 5 or 7 days is because the budget was so low. You know, we were renting just an empty room for nothing, you know, in a friend's parents' building.
Thank you.
just have to be at our most productive, most creative, most efficient, no distractions. I mean, that's a nice thing about it. No one else there, not even an engineer, no producer, nobody to argue with or to have to explain ourselves to. It was just the four of us. We really love being able to work with each other that way. So it's a funny combination of being very wild when the recording is going, but then very perfectionistic for the next several months after the recording's been done.
Why is the new album called The Magic?
It's sort of like a self-dare, actually. It's what I hope we can pull off every night, you know? Because we have these songs that actually the songs are pretty simple, pretty short, you know, a couple riffs on the guitar. But like every night when we're on tour and on stage, it's like we have to make it turn into something that matters in that moment for those people. If we play the same song that we played last time, we have to do something different with it. We're always casting around and reacting to each other in a kind of risky way. Any one of the four of us might throw a monkey wrench into the musical performance at any moment that the other three doesn't expect, and then the other three have to sort of adjust somehow. Somebody suddenly plays a loud note in the middle of a quiet part, and so everybody else has to try and decide, like, do I ignore it? Do I also play a loud note? Does it change the way I feel about the next three bars? And this sort of constant negotiation of how the music is played, kind of loose and rough. We're daring ourselves to try and like pull off that magic every time that we have a show. If a song were a direct translation of one specific thing, point that you had to make, well, then why wouldn't you just say the point? There's something else there, and we don't even necessarily know why. I mean, there's songs that we have been playing for almost 20 years in the set list that I still feel like, wow, tonight I think we almost got it, you know? We haven't quite found the right way to play the song, but we're getting really close.
That's Greg Saunier, the drummer and co-founder of Deerhoof, talking with freelance producer Max Savage Levinson. We've got more information about Deerhoof on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's our show for today. Coming up Friday on Maryland Morning, I'll talk with Joshua Harris, the Green Party nominee for mayor of Baltimore, about his vision for the future of Charm City. And composer James Lee III joins me for a discussion of his new oratorio, Mother's Lament, which he composed in response to the April 2015 uprising in Baltimore. Hope you'll join us. I'm Tom Hall. The Writer's Almanac is up next. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.